This is The Guardian.
Welcome to Weekend, a podcast that helps you switch off from your busy day to day and find entertainment and inspiration in the best Guardian and Observer writing from the week. You can either listen to this as one podcast or play each article as individual listens. Just scroll down the description on the podcast page for the timings of what we are featuring. Coming up, beware of Tetsu Rishi, warns John Crace, as the Prime Minister struggles to control his anger during the Rwanda Bill press briefing. David Harewood on acting, racism and mental health. The surprisingly simple solution to Phil Dowse insomnia hell. And Stuart Heritage examines the dangerous fallout from Netflix's Baby Reindeer.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Just a warning. There's a bit of bad language in this episode. Now, Rishi Sunak is in full-on aggressive-aggressive mode, according to John Crace, as he barely conceals his contempt for any journalists who dare to hold him to account. Read by Jonathan Keeble.
Almost every politician has their tell, the USP that betrays them. For Rishi Sunak, it's in the terse addition of right to the end of sentences. My patience is running thin, right? No ifs, no buts, right? There's a clear contrast between Labour and my government, right? This is the warning sign that the Prime Minister is yet again struggling to control his anger. The despairing cry of the Sun King, who can't believe that the fates have yet again chosen to cross his path. At Monday's Downing Street press conference on the Rwanda policy, we may just have reached peak Tetsu Rishi. Not so much snippy Rishi as outright furious Rishi. There was barely a sentence that didn't end in an accusing, right? Not so much passive-aggressive as full-on aggressive-aggressive. You could see it in his eyes, the contempt for journalists who dare to hold him to account. God knows how he feels about the voters, who appear to have turned their backs on his party in their millions. He was always meant to be the chosen one, the man to whom everything came easily. Wealth, status, he has it all. Shame he can't command the two things he most craves, respect and trust. Rish bustled into the media centre as if he was about to do the country a major favour. So we'd better be listening, as he was only going to say this once. The Labour peers have been blocking the bill, right? He began. We were only on the first sentence, and already we had come to the first untruth. Most of the delays in the passage of the bill had been as a result of failures of government timetabling. But hey, easier to blame Labour than admit many in your party have serious doubts about the legislation. Not least dozens of Tory peers who didn't bother turning up to the upper chamber because they didn't want to defend a crap bill. Where was Lord Lebedev when you needed him? Enough was enough, Sunak continued. The bill was going through on Tuesday regardless of how long it took, because Rish had a plan and the plan was working. The Rwanda bill was the only effective deterrent. So effective that during the press conference, the latest figures on small boats crossing the Channel were released. Up 24% on last year. What further evidence did anyone need of the efficacy of the Rwanda policy? Rish had always said Rwanda was a safe country. In fact, earlier that day, Andrew Mitchell, his deputy foreign minister, Lord Big Dave was unavailable, had told the Today programme that Kigali was far safer than London, and that it was racist to think that sending death squads into the Democratic Republic of the Congo was anything but recreational hijinks. So here was the proof. Rwanda was so safe that more refugees were deliberately coming to the UK precisely so they could get deported to Kigali, a modern-day utopia. In fact, Rwanda was such a paradise that he was even thinking of sending all those people with physical and mental health problems who were too lazy to do the patriotic thing of either die or work, die preferably, to Rwanda. Because at heart, he was all heart. Here was what really made Sunak so furious. His critics, on the left, the centre and even further right, all just dismissed his plan as an unworkable stunt. How very dare they! Performative cruelty to prop up his flatlining polling. But really, he was just overwhelmed with compassion for the little people. He wanted the best for them, just so long as they ended up nowhere near him. Then we got on to the logistics. Mr. Angry now channeled Mr. Don't Fuck With Me. Rish had commandeered 25 courtrooms and 150 judges, which presumably means the already overworked legal system will grind to a standstill over the summer. And he had hired 500 goons who were prepared to strong-arm any reluctant refugees onto the aircraft. Best of all, he had found an as-yet unidentified commercial airline that wasn't bothered about reputational damage or being sued in the international courts, that was dim enough to take the deportees to Rwanda. So, it was all systems go. Sort of. Maybe. Obviously, the first flights wouldn't take off for 12 weeks or so. That made a summer election unlikely, and Rish was prepared to ignore any international court. The only truth that mattered was his truth. He had said that Rwanda was safe, and that was an end to it. Hell, the country was so safe that 99% of its population had voted for its president, Paul Kagame. You can't get much safer than that. Just imagine how safe the UK would be if Sunak could get 99% of the vote. You can judge me on this. Right, he said threateningly, daring any reporter to contradict him. There wasn't going to be just one token flight. Right, there were going to be dozens. Hundreds even. Right? You get me? He wasn't going to rest until every single one of the 40,000 refugees who have disappeared into the dark economy had been rounded up and harassed out of the country. That's what success looks like. Right? Right? Wrong, wrong, wrong. Sunak was quite selective about who he took questions from. Primarily the more sympathetic media outlets. Certainly not The Guardian. Don't you love your country, Pippa? Right? But even the likes of GB News and Talk TV had their doubts. Hadn't Rish already failed? First he had promised to stop the boats. Then he had said the first flights would take off in the spring. Now we were back to late summer at the earliest. Rish was horrified. How dare anyone question him? He wasn't a man who was used to being doubted. Whatever he says is the truth, even if he contradicts what he said the day before. It was going to work because he believed in it, as did the Rwandan president. There was no man on the planet more committed to the cause of human rights than Kagame, a shoo-in for the next Nobel Peace Prize, shared with Sunak, Natch. With his self-beatification complete, Rish stomped off to take his anger out on someone else. His dog would do well to make himself scarce.
That was Struggling to Control His Anger, Tetsu Rishi Went Full On Aggressive Aggressive by John Crace. Read by Jonathan Keeble. Next, David Harewood had barely started his career when racist abuse left him mentally ill, but he went on to phenomenal success. As he takes the helm of the UK's leading drama school, he tells Steve Rose how he hopes to change things for the next generation. Read by Ben Aragundade.
This is the first time David Harewood has stepped through the doors of RADA's London headquarters since he became its president in mid-February, and he's immediately struck by flashbacks of his time as a student here. "Stunning memories," he says. "Memories of my audition, the paintings, and that staircase will always be memorable because you walk in and you go, 'Oh my God, I'm at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.' It's very evocative." Harewood, aged 58, is the first person of colour to lead RADA, and he follows in the footsteps of such luminaries as Kenneth Branagh, Richard Attenborough, Princess Diana and John Gielgud. It is the most prestigious of acting schools, some would say the loveliest of them all, training ground for everyone from Anthony Hopkins to Tom Hiddleston, Fiona Shaw to Phoebe Waller-Bridge. But like many British drama schools, at the height of the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, RADA issued an apology acknowledging that it has been and currently is institutionally racist. Harewood's appointment, alongside that of another black actor, Cynthia Erivo, as vice president, could be seen as a move towards righting those wrongs, but he's not just here for the symbolism. In fact, his experience makes him uniquely qualified, he says. "I've been to the Golden Globes and the Emmys. I've seen the glamorous top end of the industry. But I've also been in a mental institution because of this industry, so I know both sides of it. And I want to make sure that I can give the students access to as much of my experience, good and bad, as possible, so that they know what to possibly expect." We're in a sunny meeting room just off that staircase. A pile of unopened letters awaits Harewood on the table. "He's been filming in Canada for the past few months," he explains, "but he seems fresh and full of energy. I came into this room a few weeks before I was sectioned," he observed. This would have been in 1989, a few years after he had left as a student. "In my psychotic state, I came in to pitch an idea to the then principal, Oliver Neville, about how to teach the students." Harewood has spoken and written openly about his breakdown since, which was, he reasons, partly induced by the racism of British society in general, and the entertainment industry in particular. Race issues continue to plague British drama. In February, Rishi Sunak condemned a West End theatre for its plans to stage two performances of Jeremy O'Harris's slave play out of a 13-week run for all black-identifying audiences in order to make it as accessible as possible. "Restricting audiences on the basis of race would be wrong," said a government spokesperson. Earlier this month, it was reported that the black actor Francesco Amewuda Rivers had received a barrage of deplorable racist abuse on social media as a result of being cast as Juliet opposite Tom Holland in a new production of Romeo and Juliet. Harewood can sympathise. His first professional gig in 1988 was playing Romeo in an all-black adaptation of Shakespeare, which provoked a similar reaction. "Oh my God, I got slaughtered," he recalls. One reviewer said, "Apparently this man went to RADA. Why did they let him in? Why did they let him out?" Another one said, "He doesn't look like Romeo. He looks more like Mike Tyson." And rather than social media, this was coming from broadsheet newspapers. "Every interview I did was about my colour. Why are you playing Romeo? Should you be playing Romeo? Did Shakespeare write it for a black actor?" The experience affected him deeply, he says. "My second job was with the same director, and that's when things really start to go bad. Literally, the only way I could go on stage was to get hammered. I really didn't enjoy my experience, hated acting, hated the profession, hated what I was doing, totally lost my confidence. I think that was the start of my breakdown." Harewood slowly came undone, he recalled in The Guardian in 2021. He was smoking a lot of weed at the time. He spent weeks walking all over London, sometimes through the night, talking to strangers and following them wherever they led me. I'd black out, only to regain consciousness in a completely different part of town, hours later, afraid and with absolutely no idea what had happened in the interval. Friends intervened and he was sectioned, after which he went on to rebuild his career, getting by on what small roles the UK industry had to offer. He married in 2013 and has two daughters, now aged 18 and 21, both of whom are in higher education. But, like so many black British actors, he only gained mainstream recognition when he went to the US. In 2011, he was cast as a CIA chief in the hit counterterrorism series, Homeland. He hadn't worked for a year before that, but he's been busy ever since, on stage and on the small screen, from a juicy role in DC's Supergirl series to BBC documentaries on his psychosis, on COVID's disproportionate impacts on people of colour, and on the history of blackface. He wasn't seeking a role at RADA. About a year ago, the chairman, Marcus Ryder, offered him the job out of the blue. Harewood's first reaction was, "What? It doesn't make any sense. No, I can't do that," he says. And then I sort of thought, "Okay, I'll give it a go." It was only when it was announced that he realized what a big deal it was. I had calls, letters from all over the world. My Instagram blew up, and it was such an incredibly positive, excited response. I suddenly realized, this is actually fucking huge, and I'm really proud of it. Probably more proud of it than anything else I've ever done. Drama school was something of a haven for Harewood, it seems, especially compared with his experiences immediately either side of it. The child of a working-class Barbadian immigrant family, he grew up in Birmingham, where being chased by skinheads and having bricks thrown through his window was part of his daily experience. "I knew nothing about drama," he says. "I blagged my way through school, always doing plays, being a bit of a mischievous little bastard, being kicked out of classes on a regular basis. It was only when a teacher suggested acting that a light bulb came on in his head. He was accepted by the National Youth Theatre, came to London for a 6-week course, and found this tribe of people who messed about just like me and had funny voices just like me and were very mischievous just like me. A year later, he was walking into this building for a day-long audition, at the end of which almost all of the other applicants had been eliminated. Then Neville, the principal, said to him, "You're quite a humorous lad. Can you make me laugh?" What did he do? It was terribly silly. It was almost like a Lenny Henry sketch. I was like a Rastafarian Santa Claus breaking into people's houses and talking to himself. He went home thinking he'd blown it, but the acceptance letter came through days later. I just read the first 3 words, "We are pleased," and I leapt out of my fucking skin. I just had an absolute ball here. For me, it was the first time education made sense. I was learning about literature, Shakespeare, Chekhov and Moliere, all these fantastic classical writers, what they were writing about, the analogies they were using, and things that they were trying to point out to society. It just completely sparked my imagination. In retrospect, there were some aspects that were pretty racist. "I was singing Negro spirituals," he says, laughing. "I wanted to sing jazz, and my music teacher was like, 'No, no, no.'" He pounds the table as if playing a piano and sings in a loud Paul Robeson-style baritone. "I got plenty or nothing." And I'm like, "What the fuck is this?" His impersonation is so funny, I can't help laughing as well, even though we're talking about institutional racism. There was only one other black man in his year at RADA, he recalls. Though times were already changing, the year below him included Adrian Lester, Sophie Okonedo, and Marianne Jean-Baptiste. People of colour now make up about 40% of RADA's intake, it says. It gets 3,000 to 4,000 applications a year, for the 28 places on its acting BA, and successful applicants must get through 4 rounds of auditions. "Today's students of colour are far more aware of race matters," says Harewood, though this comes with its own challenges. He has heard of students rejecting suggestions that they study Shakespeare or Chekhov. A young black actor now will say, I want a black playwright. I want black directors. I want. So it's a different perspective. Alternative routes are now available. He praises London's Identity Acting School, whose alumni include John Boyega and Letitia Wright, actors who are comfortably themselves. When we were coming out of school, the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theatre were the peak of an actor's career. Kids aren't necessarily interested in that anymore. They can come out of drama school and get a six-season Netflix show. There are other issues facing today's generation he doesn't envy, though. Rada was once caricatured as a bastion of poshness, but at least actors from lower-income families, like Harewood, could get a student grant. Now there are fears that drama school is exclusively for the well-off. It's a problem across higher education, he says. So I don't think it's specifically to do with Rada. But I do think we have to find ways of making that ladder to success accessible to all. It'd be a shame if the only way you could get here is if mum and dad can dip into their pockets. Rada's fees are set by the government at £9,250 a year for UK students, just like other undergraduate courses, a spokesman tells me, and it supports 60% of its undergraduates through its scholarship fund. Harewood is also concerned about where identity politics could be headed. We're at this strange point in the profession where people go, oh, you can't play that role because you're not disabled, or you can't play that because you're not really from there. The name of the game is acting. Yes, we've got to be representative, but I do think we have to be careful. That even extends to Othello in blackface. I say, if you want to black up, have at it, man. It better be fucking good, or else you're going to get laughed off the stage. But knock yourself out. Anybody should be able to do anything. Harewood has practiced what he's preaching. Last year he played the notorious white conservative William F. Buckley in the play Best of Enemies, based on Buckley's legendary right versus left TV debates with Gore Vidal in 1968. I knew the minute I walked on stage, 99% of the audience was thinking, why is he playing that? But by the end of it, everybody was going, fuck me, that worked really well, says Harewood. Hearing his words coming out of my mouth, many people went, why am I liking William F. Buckley? This was a far cry from the 23-year-old Harewood who played Romeo. You bring onto the stage what you are. I'm not pretending to be white. I'm bringing my full self. How will his Rada role affect his acting career? Well, Ken did pretty well, didn't he? He laughs, as in his predecessor, Kenneth Branagh. I'd like to be involved here as much as I can, and I would have to be honest and say that my career has slowed down. No one's banging down my door right now. That said, there seems to be plenty in the pipeline. In Canada, he was shooting a movie about Denham Jolly, the founder of Canada's first black-owned radio station, way back in 2001. He's returning there next week to work on a new TV show, Happy Face, and he's set to appear in the second series of the BBC's hit show, Sherwood, among other projects. Being an actor is a weird balancing act, he suggests. On the one hand, you've got to be sufficiently resilient to handle all the criticism, rejection, anxiety, and stress. On the other, he's realized, the goal is to be open and vulnerable. On a personal level, Harewood seems to have squared that circle. I always thought you had to puff your chest out on stage and be rock solid. And then after my breakdown, the first time I got on stage, I was terrified. And there's something interesting in that because I was vulnerable. I've embraced that. And it adds something to my level of character because I'm safe in that vulnerability. I'm in a much better place now than I've ever been. A few days later, Harewood contacts me by email. When he got home that day, he says, he got round to tackling the pile of unopened mail that was sitting on the table during our interview. It was all wonderful and complimentary, except the second to last one that began, "The true patriots of England will be turning in their grave at your appointment." I didn't read on, but I could see it was full of the usual. My wife read the first line and laughed, but I could see her expression change as she read on, and she very quickly ripped it to shreds and threw it in the bin. I've already put systems in place, as I've had to do before, where such mail is opened by others first. That way, I don't have to deal with such garbage.
That was I Was Only Able to Go on Stage Hammered, David Harewood on Acting, Racism and His New Role at RADA by Steve Rose. Read by Ben Aragundade. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back with the second half of this episode in a moment. Don't go anywhere.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back to Weekend. Now, pills, meditation, yoga, sleep restriction. Phil Dowse has tried absolutely everything to get some proper rest. But is the solution actually surprisingly simple? Read by Jonathan Keeble.
I'm standing in my bedroom, in my boxers and a t-shirt, while a man I've just met fiddles with my legs. His name is Parasarathi, and he's here with his boss Julius, who has come to set me up for a polysomnogram, a.k.a. a sleep study. Once they have glued electrodes all over my legs, chest and head, and stuck a cannula into my nostrils and clipped a monitor to one of my fingers and strapped more electronics to my chest and waist, and trained an infrared camera on my bed and given the Guardian's photographer a good laugh, they'll be leaving me for the night. Then all this kit will track how long and deeply I am sleeping, how much I am snoring, how twitchy my legs are, how often I get out of bed, whether I talk, walk, or, I don't know, juggle in my sleep, what's happening to my blood oxygen levels, what my heart's doing, and, crucially, how well I'm breathing. The answer to that last one turns out to be not very well. I later learn that I stopped breathing for at least 10 seconds that night. Not once, not twice, but 60 times. That's an average of almost 10 times an hour. What the hell, I think. At the same time, I'm comforted. Maybe I'm getting closer to fixing my insomnia. It's been a problem for at least half my life, and now I've decided to live to 100. I don't want it screwing up my final 40 years. It increases the risk of heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and depression, as well as accidents like crashing your car or walking in front of a bus. How bad is mine? Most nights I don't get much more than 5 hours sleep. I wake at least once in the small hours, often twice or more, and if I wake up any time after 4 a.m, there's a good chance I won't fall asleep again. I think you'd call me a high-functioning insomniac. I don't feel terrible most days, just a little tired. It hasn't stopped me holding down a good job, getting married, having a family, and the fatigue is mainly mental. I can usually manage a run or an exercise class or some yoga, as well as a full day's work. A woman recently wrote to The Guardian asking if I had servants. How else could I fit everything in? It's simple, madam. I rarely get more than 20 winks. But I wish I did. There are moments when I'm drifting off, almost always when I'm lying on my back, when I feel something I can only describe as bliss. I bathe in that warm ooze of well-being, a smile in my heart, until my wife Hannah pokes me to complain I'm snoring. There are certainly times that euphoria would come in handy. I've had 2 brief episodes of depression and anxiety, both bad enough to need medication. Both times I was sleeping particularly poorly. I don't think that's the only reason I became ill. but it felt as if the misery and the insomnia were feeding each other. Maybe I just need to improve my sleep hygiene. Don't you start. This is all you ever hear about if you're struggling to sleep, from every expert, book, website, app, audiobook, or well-meaning stranger. If you're lucky enough never to have encountered the concept, it simply means doing everything you can to encourage sleep while stopping everything that may undermine it. Entirely off the top of my head, I can tell you that this includes 1. Making sure your bedroom is dark and quiet. 2. Getting plenty of daylight first thing, maybe with a long walk. 3. Getting plenty of exercise generally, though not too late in the day. 4. Avoiding blue light from screens in the evening. 5. Not sleeping next to your phone. 6. Turning down the lights as you approach bedtime. 7. Avoiding social media and other rage-inducing stimuli late at night. 8. Going to bed and rising at about the same time, even when you really, really fancy a lie-in. 9. Keeping the lights off if you must get up to use the toilet. 10. Keeping caffeine to a minimum, avoiding it completely in the evening. 11. Ditto booze. 12. Leaving at least a few hours between your last meal and bedtime, so you're not still working hard to digest it. 13. Not eating too much for dinner, for the same reason. 14. Using your bed only for sex and sleep. 15. Getting out of bed if you've been awake for more than 20 to 30 minutes, then moving to another room where you should do something soporific. 16. Trying not to check the time when you're in bed. And 17. Clearing your mind before bed by making a to-do or to-worry-about list. I could go on. You know what? Following these rules almost certainly will help you sleep better. The same goes for meditation / mindfulness, breathing exercises, yoga and tai chi, all of which I have tried and enjoyed, and all of which have helped a little. They all relax you. In the jargon, engage your parasympathetic nervous system, and some you can practice while lying unhappily in bed. Experts quite rightly try to give sufferers the confidence they will one day overcome their problems, not least because worrying only makes it harder to sleep. But the truth is, none of this is guaranteed to get you all the way. Not even the treatment often described as the gold standard, sleep restriction, which is usually combined with most of those rules in a program of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. The aim is to create a strong association between your bed and sleep, as opposed to reading, working, watching TV, etc., and especially tossing and turning. I recently endured almost 6 months of this, during 2 of which I had weekly phone calls with my local NHS CBTI service. Approaches vary a little, but the basic principle of sleep restriction is to work out how much shut-eye you are getting in your horrible underslept state. 5 hours, for instance. Add another 30 minutes, and then allow yourself only that long in bed for night after night until exhaustion has bludgeoned you into sleeping solidly for at least a week, at which point you get an extra 15 or 20 minutes. Once you've proved you can make the most of this, you get another 15 or 20 minutes, and so on until you can't improve any more. Well done, you. Even before you start all this, it's clear it's going to be an enormous pain in the balls. You're warned that you will be even more tired than usual, and more irritable, and find it harder to focus, and that you should tell your family, friends, and workmates so they can make allowances. All of that is true. None of it quite captures the grim tedium of staying up past midnight for 7, 14, 21, 28 nights in a row, exhaustedly observing those loathsome rules. Imagine, sitting droopy-eyed in a darkened room, long after everyone else has gone to bed, listening to an audiobook that won't overstimulate you, and trying your damnedest to stay awake because, let's call this rule number 18, it's not a great idea to nap. And if you do, it shouldn't be for long, and definitely not in the evening. It's not quite hell, but it's definitely purgatory. What you will learn en route is that it is remarkably difficult to be sure how much you are sleeping. We routinely wake up in the night and forget about it by the morning, or even think we have been awake when we have actually been sleeping. This is known in extreme cases as paradoxical insomnia. And remember rule number 16? You must not check the time during the night. As for wearables, such as the Apple Watch, the Aura Smart Ring or the Whoop Tracker Band, all of which aim to chart not just your hours sleep, but the amount you spent in light sleep, deep sleep and REM sleep, I've tried them all, and I wouldn't rate them any more than 7 out of 10. They are particularly erratic when it comes to distinguishing between sleep and lying really still, like when you're awake and try not to be. Does sleep restriction work? I'm sure it does for most people. I began to sleep a little longer and with a little less disruption, but I still wasn't sleeping well. I began to wonder if I ever would. Have I tried pills? Of course, and I'd probably have used them more if I could get the good stuff. Lormatazepam, which I was prescribed when living in France, is rarely dispensed in Britain, partly because of fears of addiction, and partly because of other possible side effects. It worked well for me, and I could genuinely take it or leave it. But the problem with that argument is that the more you repeat it to your doctor, the less convincing it sounds. Amitriptyline, which is readily available, left me muzzy. I binned it completely after one horrible morning of irritable, spaced-out jitters. I've just been prescribed Zopiclone, which a friend tells me is wonderful. But this is another drug that GPs are wary of, and I've only got 7 pills, so I'm keeping them for emergencies. And in any case, pills rarely give you proper, restful sleep. Sometimes a few hours of unconsciousness is all you need to stop spiralling, but it's not a long-term solution. As for the over-the-counter, non-prescription sleep aids, I have spent a fortune on Nitol, Valerian, Magnesium, 5-HTP, Lavender and Black Cherry gummies. Nitol One a Night, the hardcore version with antihistamines, did some good. The rest were as useless as they were expensive, though the gummies were tasty. And what about the holy grail for self-medicating insomniacs, the hormone melatonin, widely recommended for jet lag and other sleep problems? It's available over-the-counter in the US and many other parts of the world, but only on prescription in the UK. I tried it for months, in every dose from 1.9 milligrams to 10 milligrams, in quick-acting and timed-release forms. When it had any effect, which wasn't always, I reckon it made me sleep a little more soundly and just a little longer. Helpful, maybe. Magic bullet? Not for me. A few weeks ago, I spoke to a doctor who had done a lot of work with sleep. He said I shouldn't write off the progress I had made with the hygiene and the CBTI and the sleep restriction. These things take time, and was I familiar with the Japanese concept of Kaizen, or continuous improvement? You create something, then you add a bell to make it a little better, then a whistle, then another bell. That was a helpful way to think about my achievements, such as they were. Then he told me about a new type of sleeping pill called an orexin receptor antagonist. How do you spell that? I asked. Anyway, when I arranged to spend a night decked out like a Christmas tree, it wasn't because I thought a polysomnogram would help me. Dr. Sandeep Chohan's Kaizen seemed like my best, probably only, hope of success. But after being so frustrated by my attempts to measure my sleep, I was interested in the proper way to do it, the test that doctors rely on. Enter a company called Independent Physiological Diagnostics, IPD, which brings polysomnography to your home rather than making you check into a sleep clinic. In between fitting me with all those electrodes and cannulas and so on, Julius Patrick, a clinical physiologist as well as IPD's managing director, checks my throat and asks me questions designed to help with the analysis. Do I ever wake up gasping for air? No, thank God. And don't you think I'd have mentioned it? Do I have headaches in the morning? Nope. Do I get brain fog? What was the question? How often do I pee in the night? Too often. Do I ever have nightmares or night terrors? Again, no. And do I dream? Surprisingly rarely, I tell him. Oh, everyone does, he says, but not everyone remembers it. And you know what? No sooner do I fall asleep than I jerk awake and tell Hannah I've been trying to catch a spider in a glass. It's so huge that its legs stick out and it just scuttles away, taking the tumbler with it. Then I'm out cold again. That's not the real surprise, though. A few days later, Dr. Oliver Bernath, the neurologist who reviews my test results, announces that I have moderate obstructive sleep apnea. I'd heard about apnea before, but always associated it with bigger bodies, daytime sleepiness and dramatic symptoms, like the aforementioned gasping for air. It turns out to be far more widespread and often less spectacular. According to the Sleep Apnea Trust, it affects up to 10 million people in the UK, 4 million of them moderately or severely. The vast majority of cases go undetected, so that people like me, who have what Patrick describes as regular arousal from sleep, end up focusing on other causes. That's not to say you can't have more than one reason for terrible sleep, hence the term comesa, or comorbid insomnia with sleep apnea. Bernath recommends I get treatment to reduce the long-term risk of cardiovascular complications. This may also improve the subjective experience of sleep quality. This is, despite the muted language, a game changer. I finally have an explanation for my problems and a way to tackle them. If the worst comes to the worst, I might need a continuous positive airway pressure CPAP machine to feed me air during the night. Well, I admit my heart sinks at the thought of wearing a mask to sleep, and not just because it feels like a memento mori. As my wife likes to remind me, at 50 she is considerably younger than me, and I'd rather not give her another excuse to tease me. And then there's Stevie, our sweet but nervous rescue dog, who usually spends the night under our bed. He already freaks out when one of the kids turns up in a new hat or a novelty wig. He will quite possibly wet himself if he sees me attached to a CPAP machine. But there's a good chance it won't come to that. The apnea only occurs when I'm supine, that is, on my back, so I may be able to avoid it just by sleeping on my side. The thought makes me a little sad, given how much I enjoy a supine snooze, but it's clearly going to have to stop. To make that a reality, my options seem to be good old willpower, the sort of V-shaped pillow that's popular with pregnant women, or a device that will stop me rolling onto my back. This could be one of the traditional anti-snoring hacks, like a tennis ball sewn into the back of a pyjama top, a special backpack, or something electronic that will prod me if I deviate from the correct position. I immediately go online and order the pregnancy pillow, then add a belt that will give me a little electric shock every time I go astray. It's early days, but I've been trying a combination of pillow and willpower for the last week, and so far the signs are good. I'm sleeping better than I have for ages, on my side, obviously, and waking up more refreshed. If I start backsliding, I'll move on to the belt, and then the CPAP machine. My ego, Stevie and Hannah will all just have to suck it up. Sorry, Stevie. Sorry, Hannah. After decades slugging it out with insomnia, I think I've got it on the ropes. I'm actually looking forward to the next 14,000 nights.
That was My Insomnia Hell. Sleeplessness is a curse, but I think I finally have the answer, by Phil Doust. Read by Jonathan Keeble. Finally, this week, the internet has been rife with speculation about the real-life stalker and real-life abuser from the Netflix hit Baby Reindeer. So, is this show about exploitation starting to seem uncomfortably careless, even exploitative? Asked Stuart Heritage. Read by Ben Aragundade.
Baby Reindeer was only released a little over a week ago, and already it has become a sensation. Richard Gadd's adaptation of his 2019 Edinburgh Festival one-man show which in turn was a dramatization of the ordeals he had been through at the hands of a stalker and a powerful abuser, respectively, has not only been the most watched Netflix show in the UK, but made the top 10 in 12 other countries. And quite right too, since it's as gripping and queasy and uncomfortable a show as you're ever likely to see. But unintended consequences can come with success. The narrative surrounding Baby Reindeer has moved away from the show this week and into the real world. Besides its lead, the show is essentially about two people, a middle-aged woman who spent years inundating Gad with thousands of unwanted messages to the detriment of his well-being, and a successful older writer who subjected Gad to a prolonged period of sexual abuse. And while Baby Reindeer attempted to gloss over the true identity of these figures, the internet has, unfortunately, been busy. In recent days, online sleuths have found online accounts purportedly belonging to Gad's real-life stalker and have been speculating wildly about the identity of his abuser. This reached fever pitch on Monday, meaning Gad had to dampen things down on Instagram. He said that people he loves and admires were unfairly getting caught up in speculation. "Please don't speculate on who any of the real-life people could be. That's not the point of our show." Which might be true, since Baby Reindeer is a complex drama. But any show that openly states it is based on a true story will always invite internet detectives. And if the result of that is that innocent people are now being wrongly accused of being abusers online, that's a problem. The tension at the heart of Baby Reindeer is that the story is real. Gad was stalked and suffered abuse, and the knowledge that these things happened gives the whole endeavor its electric charge. But equally, the knowledge that the writer and star is retelling traumas that he endured also means that the series cannot be viewed solely as a work of art. People were always going to start trying to join the dots. The internet has done so for decades. Even Fleabag, a much less thematically explosive show, drew a similar level of attention, to the extent that Phoebe Waller-Bridge publicly expressed regret for harming her family by not protecting them from all the guesswork. This is the wider context in which Baby Reindeer was released. And to have not seen this coming seems like an oversight on the part of Netflix. It could all have been prevented so easily. In some of the press reports about Baby Reindeer, Gad has suggested that a huge effort had gone into separating the fictional stalker from the real-life stalker, as a way of protecting the latter from undue attention. Yet enough details of her life and her messaging are included in the drama that amateur investigators immediately set about trying to identify her. Similarly, regardless of the actual identity of Gad's abuser, the show has resulted in several people in the public eye being hounded by speculation. Wouldn't it have been safer to fudge the details more comprehensively? True, the show is based on a stage show that made the reality of Gad's experiences even more explicit, but the percentage of Netflix's 269 million subscribers, with a working knowledge of Edinburgh Fringe shows from half a decade ago, is presumably quite small. Leaving off the true story disclaimer could have thrown the majority of people off the scent. It has become hard to think of Baby Reindeer the show without considering the fallout it has generated. While the instinct might have initially been to see Gad as brave for so fearlessly retelling the story of what must have been an impossibly harrowing time, it's now difficult to see it free of the consequences it has brought on itself. There's nothing entertaining or fun about the worst percentage of the internet doxing women with mental health problems or scattergunning accusations of abuse at celebrities for fun, and yet this is what has happened. Baby Reindeer has cemented its status as one of the year's most uncomfortable shows.
That was The Dangerous Fallout from Baby Reindeer. Should Richard Gad have been less honest about his abusers? By Stuart Heritage. Read by Ben Aragundade. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode, we've included details of helplines you can contact on the episode page at theguardian.com. That's all from us. This has been Weekend, a Guardian podcast. If you're enjoying it, please make sure to like, subscribe to, and rate the podcast. maybe even leave us a nice review, or let us know what you want to hear more of. Just search for Weekend wherever you get your podcasts. This week's articles are read by Jonathan Keeble and Ben Aragundade, and presented by me, Savannah Ayode-Greaves. This episode was produced by Rachel Porter. The executive producer is Ellie Bury. Join us again next Saturday. Thanks for listening.
This is The Guardian.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.